The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Tip top, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his Pilates instructor, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 45 of The Big Picture for the week beginning February 7. And coming up in today's show, we know what your kids will be watching on telly this year. Yes, we do. And we can tell you.
The painful inner worlds of Apple computer king Steve Jobs, as well as a trapped mother and son in two different movies out this week.
Finally, the truth is revealed about what it's really like to take a baby to the cinema. Have you tried it?
Dun, dun, dun. You may or may not when you listen to what we've got in store about that later in the show. Mark, great to see you.
Mate, it's great to be back again for the second show of the year. It's still nice and fresh. I feel like it was the first show of the year.
I'm just happy you made it back. Should we dive straight into it?
We should. This week, what's coming up out in film?
Films, a movie that I think a lot of listeners probably won't be going to check out, but they're definitely going to hear about it and it's going to get a lot of talk. The Danish Girl, which has been nominated for a bunch of different Oscars.
Yeah.
It's based on the true story of 1920s Danish artist who is rumored to be one of the first people to have gender reassignment surgery, as in is a guy becomes a girl. So it's a movie for our time, right? We're in an age that's obsessed with identity, particularly sexual gender identity, and being in total control of that. So The Danish Girl hits cinemas. Expect people to be talking about it this week.
No worries. Also on TV, if you're a fan of Jack Irish, you'll be happy to know he's back from this Thursday on the good old ABC. Three successful telemovies has now given birth to Guy Pearce's return in an expanded six-part series, which will take us from the cultural atoll of Fitzroy to the bustling city of Manila in the Philippines.
Speaking of TV shows making a return, but making some of a return to DVD and Blu-ray, although I think they're also on streaming as well, Sherlock. The Sherlock special, The Abominable Bride.
Which I have seen.
Is it good?
It's fantastic.
There you go. If you're a Sherlock fan, you're going to like this. Isn't it set back in ye olde Victorian London-y times?
Indeed.
Not the present day, as Sherlock tends to be.
That's right. The present Sherlock Holmes, now they're revamping them and putting them in the 1800s. It's fantastic.
Wow,
very
quite,
clever.
Quite the revamp. So that's Sherlock the Abominable Bride out now.
Also, if you're looking for something really good on TV at the moment.
Yes, I am.
Can't go past SBS and The Family Law, based on the best-selling memoir by Benjamin Law. It's an insightful comedy about a sprawling Chinese family of seven and their first generation, second generation struggles. It's your chance to really sort of come to terms with ethnic Australia in a fun way. 8:30 p.m. Thursdays on SBS.
Turns out, Mark, that there is no end to the Marvel Cinematic Universe on screen.
What? I've been setting my watch.
No end in sight at all ever. The Disney chairman, Bob Iger, announced, and I kid you not, he said there are thousands of Marvel comic characters that they still haven't had their chance to get up on the big screen, so expect them to come sometime between now and the end of time.
And our great-great-grandchildren will be going, when did this all begin?
I know, I haven't seen that movie yet about the Black Panther or that Luke Cage guy. I know there's a TV show about him. So anyway, expect every single character ever in Marvel to hit the screen sometime in the next millennia.
Talk about milking a franchise. Okay, and actually on the similar note, okay, though DC instead of Marvel, we're all aware that the film Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, is coming March 24. It's going to be a huge event in the calendar. You may not want to miss it. But many have questioned whether the third big player in the film, Wonder Woman, should have been included in the title. Okay. Well, she is now getting her own film due for release in 2017. The great Amazonian superhero princess warrior Diana, tutored in the ways of the Greek warriors, will grace our screens, adding yet another layer to the DC universe. Plot details are vague, as is the entire concept, but it's early days yet.
So basically, comic book superheroes are never going to end on our cinema screens ever.
We might have a whole show.
Mark, last week we introduced a new segment to the lineup of The Big Picture for 2016, True or False. And so for True or False this week...
Pop quiz, hot shot.
Here we go. Is what I'm about to say true or is it false?
I'm ready.
Alfred Hitchcock was so obsessed with the book Psycho that he read it 27 times before he filmed it. I'll repeat that. Alfred Hitchcock was so obsessed with the book Psycho that he read it 27 times before he filmed it. Is that true or is that false?
27. He was obsessive compulsive.
He was very obsessive.
27. I think even that's a bit much, though. Like, you know, after about the fourth one, you probably know who did it.
Oh, so you're going with false or are you going with true?
I'll go with false.
Okay, well, We'll find out what the answer is after we let you know what your kids are watching in 2016.
Well, speaking of what your kids are watching, the new year, new stuff coming our way on the big and on the small screen, well, screens, with about 55 million different ways to view nowadays.
That was at last count. I think there's 55 million different ways.
55 million yep. different ways of viewing. Mm-hmm. We could have lost one or two there. Yep. Anyway, you know that your kids will continue to make it their life's aim to gorge themselves on more TV offerings this year. Ben's looked ahead at 2016's TV horizon to scout out what your kids will be watching this year and report back on how to be well prepared.
You ever hear about the rising phoenix? Us living as we do, upside down. The pale-faced media tells us we all going to hell, but maybe we just the first ones to light the fire. Some try to snuff it out. That's like oxygen to a flame.
What's the get down?
That is the Get Down, Mark. That's one of the shows that I reckon the kids will be watching this year. It's directed by or created by Baz Luhrmann. It's been this 10-year kind of passion project of his to do a dramatic history of hip-hop. And Netflix, the streaming online provider, which also produces loads of TV shows, has got behind it.
So the Get Down. Netflix and the Get Down. That's probably a winner straight off the
because
top.
Because I reckon it sounds great.
And Baz Luhrmann, if you just ignore the whole Australia incident.
Oh, mate, I really quite liked Australia.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know. we should back up a little bit and go back to... We should stop looking in the past and head towards the future. You're right. I did go on a bit of an expedition this week looking around at what's coming up for the youngsters in 2016 on TV.
And what did you find?
I didn't find that much. I did it. Like I promised to you that I went and looked and I did as many searches as I possibly could.
You worked your little fingers to the bone.
What's coming out. And I couldn't see much. There's loads of things for, let's say, late teens or early 20s, but more the mature audience. So if you want to find out what's coming in crime series or even superhero series, but ones that are directed more towards the adult market.
Kind of like the Jessica Jones sort
of. Yeah, the ones that are on Netflix. Again, Netflix. There's plenty of information out there about it. But in terms of, and I was really trying to find like kids shows, like under 10 and that sort of thing. I didn't find much. Now, it's more of the TV man than I am. Was I just looking in the wrong places, or is there not much around when it comes to new shows for kids? Is it all being invested in mature dramas or shows for adults?
Well, there's a positive and negative to this coin. In fact, 2016 is going to be the year where, particularly locally, Australia's going to invest a lot in drama. So there are a lot of dramas coming up. That's going to be a big sort of thing on 7, 9 and 10 and the ABC. War and Peace is coming courtesy of the BBC. That's going to be a fantastic thing to look out for.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like one of those shows that you as a parent could encourage your children to watch if you felt it was right for them and appropriate for their age,
exactly.
Especially something like War and Peace,
which
is classic literature. Kids gather around because you could actually learn something from this.
And look, in all seriousness, if you had older daughters who love that sort of period drama sort of stuff, they'd probably get it. If they like Downton Abbey, they'd probably like it. But you're right in saying that there's not much actually aimed particularly at children, even though there's stuff being
or
produced.
At least new shows maybe or high-profile ones.
Well, the reason is pretty simple is that there's no dollars in it. Now, I mean, think about it. The spending market is still pretty much the golden area. It's still 18 up to, 40. In that point, that's where all your dollars are being spent. Kids are actually, in Australian television, it is an obligation to put TV on. It's not a recognised market. It's an obligation to put TV on for kids. Okay, so that's why it exists. And the ABC does it well because the ABC doesn't have to pay any attention to market forces.
Now, they're bringing a six-part, one-hour version of Tomorrow When the War Began, aren't they, to small screens this year?
Yes, that's aiming
there you go.
At kids.
That's aiming at the high schoolers. We've got the Summer Olympics that are coming this year. That's one for the whole family.
Yeah, that Seven was probably still thinking about 18 to 40 before they were thinking about kids. But that said, yeah, the same.
And so apart from that, and things like that 800 words show that was the most popular show, I think, in 2015 in Australia, that was a Channel 7 program, which I understand.
Channel 10
must appeal to, let's say, at least high in the teens. You can see I'm stretching here a bit. I was really quite baffled.
Yeah, it was kind of like packed to the rafters. But again, it's because, look, there's just not a context to actually make, particularly locally, kid-driven Australian television.
Mm.
For example, most kids' television in the world today comes out of Canada. Why does it come out? Yeah, it comes out of Canada because Canada has a very favourable tax return policy or tax credit policy for making films. And we used to have something similar to that back in the 80s and 90s in Australia. You could actually get, wait for it, like 150% tax write-off on investing in Australian productions. Okay, now there's nothing like that now. And when the federal government took that away, there ended the golden era of Australian television.
Ah, which might explain then why my hunt this week was so fruitless. So I think to wrap up then on what your kids will be watching this year in 2016, Mark, my answer at the moment is not really sure, but stay tuned to The Big Picture because we will let you know what they will be and what they should be watching this year.
That's right. Keep your eyes peeled for the release of all those shows that Ben just gave us as a lowdown on. Plus, don't worry, we will be keeping you updated about many of the new things that are actually coming through. But look, it's not like a great year for kids, but if you're into adult drama, you've got lots to look forward to on The Big Picture.
Haven't you written an article on this also that's in Eternity newspaper this month?
I do indeed, actually.
There you go. Now, this is one more, as you just said, more for the adults, more for the mature viewer. If you want to get the lowdown on a whole bunch of different shows, everything from The Get Down to The Olympics to the Return of the X-Files and War and Peace, etc.
The X-Files is coming back, the original Molly and Skulder.
You actually found plenty of shows that are coming back this year or are bursting forth this year. Check it out in Eternity. That's available right now. Before we went to what your kids are watching, Mark, I posed a true or false question.
You teased me.
I teased you with a true or false. And my question was, my statement was, Alfred Hitchcock was so obsessed with the book Psycho that he read it 27 times before filming
it. Which I believe you overreached yourself and it was false.
Oh, you are right. Instead, Alfred Hitchcock demanded his publicist buy all the copies of the book Psycho that she could get her hands on so the public would not read the book and find out the ending before the film was made. That's how obsessed that guy was.
Okay. He probably should have just stopped with reading it 27 times. But he probably did afterwards. He owned so many copies of it.
I know, but it wasn't 27. Well played on True and False this week.
Coming up in the show yet, we've actually got an incredibly moving drama called Room, which I think is well worth the effort, and also Steve Jobs, the next biopic on the founder of Apple.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. It's soundtrack time, and our choice this week has something to do with this new film, Steve Jobs, that we're about to talk about a little bit later in the program. It's a selection that it figures very prominently in this film, and it really struck me as I was sitting in the cinema, so much so that I thought, heck, let's just play it.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. Ultron, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
That is Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changing, featured very prominently in Steve Jobs. In real life in 1984, in this big launch of a Macintosh product, Steve Jobs actually quoted from the second verse of that Bob Dylan song. Apparently, he was a really big Bob Dylan fan, but he did so, I think he was quoting at that time, because he seemed to think that what he was doing up on stage was as revolutionary and as creative and artistic and all those kind of things. Basically, he's an artistic genius.
What is the Vietnam
War? He was trying to say, I'm an artistic genius, so I'm going to use Bob Dylan in my speech. The song doesn't actually feature in the movie. Other Bob Dylan songs do, but gets a very heavy mention nonetheless in Steve Jobs, which we will talk about a little bit later in the program. Mark, we're up to Now Showing for this week. And you're bringing to us a movie that you saw in the past couple of weeks. When was it released at cinemas? Last week?
It's only been out since last Thursday.
Yeah, and a bit of a shocking one, an intense one. There are some films that are just not for the faint-hearted, and that doesn't mean you don't watch them if you get the chance to. And Room, the film that we're speaking about, is definitely one of those. This fictional story about a young woman who's abducted and forced to bear and raise her captor's child. And this film sadly reflects the realities of many young women held hostage by their kidnappers, sometimes for decades at a time. Hollywood actually, if you can believe this, does a good job drawing our attention to these horrors. However, what Room fails to include from the original book, the book that it's based on, is the spiritual life that never deserted its main character.
For 5 years, you made life in that small room, that prison, as nurturing and normal as you could.
Mom, I'm 5.
You're 5.
So old now.
You are so old now.
Yep. Hey, do you know what we're going to do today?
What?
We are going to bake a birthday cake.
You chose to tell Jack that Room was the whole world, that there was nothing else.
Good morning, lamp.
Good morning, plant.
Good morning, sink.
I wanted him to feel safe and that it was a great place for him to live.
Did you ever think you would be free?
I hoped.
Hello, Jack. Thanks for saving our little girl.
It's a powerful film. There's no way, two ways about it. When I actually heard about the concept of Room, I actually rushed out and got the book. The book the screenplay was written by the author as well. The book was a New York Times bestseller, and it sat on the book New York Times bestselling list for an immense amount of weeks. It is the story of a composite story, we call it. It's something like New Journalism, where a whole lot of sort of factual events are built into a fictional story. So in the news over the decades, we've actually heard about people who've been kidnapped, raised as children by people who they've been kidnapped by, or imprisoned and forced to bear the children of their captors. In this case, we have Brie Larson playing this character called Ma. Okay, and Ma has given birth at some stage to young Jack, who's played by Jacob Tremblay. And his only world is defined by this sort of 12-foot by 12-foot room. And so Mum makes choices.
And he's never been outside.
He doesn't believe, he doesn't know what the outside is. And Mum has made some choices. She wants to raise Jack as best she can, knowing that they might never leave this room. She wants to give him the best possible experience as a child. So what she does, she makes choices about what she'll tell him, what she won't. And one of the things is that the outside is just a series of pictures. You might glimpse it through a TV screen, but that's just TV. TV isn't real. The sky is just sky. It's a small patch of blue that they see through a skylight, but that's it. And so in this world, Jack actually becomes particularly associated with and in love with all the small elements of his world. To him, this world is rich. He says hello to Mr. Lamp each night, each morning, and to Mr. Fridge. He talks to the rug. He's not in any way demented or in any way lacking in mental faculty. He's in fact actually survived this experience because his mother has loved him enough to try and make a world within this tiny world.
Why would someone want to go see this? Like, I know you found this a disturbing, quite heart-wrenching experience. Why would someone want to go?
Look, I think a good reason to begin with is to understand that our world does not have to be defined by what we have or what we don't have. You can actually be quite human and loving and amazing with the smallest of resources. I think this is a terribly powerful film. It's true. It's hard to get away from, at some moments, the trepidation and the fear. But in some respects, it's also a very triumphant story. It's about what a woman has been able to achieve through love for the sake of her child. And look, to be honest, even just the concept of having a single set for 2 hours of a film. Jack Tremblay plays an amazing... I've seldom seen a child actor this good.
He's nominated for an Oscar, isn't he? So is Brie Larson.
He is. She is too.
He should go close, even though it's the year of Leonardo DiCaprio, and they're going to give it to him for Revenant.
They're
probably going to
give it to him.
As like a... just because thank you for your whole career, Leonardo. We should have given you one earlier.
But, so let's make up for it now.
But this young lad, heard is scorching on screen.
He's incredibly good. Look, even if you wanted to see it as a film experience, I'd recommend it. But I think you should go for more than that. I think you're going to find a great story.
Now, given you are one of those guys who does read the book first, Mark, I'm definitely not one of those people. But you are.
Yeah, I'm far too much.
What are the differences? Because it sounds like you really like the movie. It doesn't sound you mustn't have too many gripes about it then.
Here's the thing. I really love the film. I think the film is great. I think that the film is a victim, though, of the Hollywood system. Because one of the strongest things in the book is the spirituality of Ma and how she teaches Jack. See, one of the important things she decides not to let go, she thinks of all the things she might or might not tell him about, she must raise him, understanding that there is a God who loves him and that we should thank God for the things that we have. And he talks to Jesus and he understands that. He has a strong relationship with God, even though there's very little she can teach him about God in that context.
So Ma and her son are close with God in that room,
absolutely,
in that little sheltered, absolutely, universe, in the one world room.
Yeah.
They're close.
And one of the disappointing things with the film is that they cut all of that out because it just doesn't fit a worldview today to say that if you are going to tell your child about anything in a terrible circumstance, you teach him to love God. Many people, and in fact the film version,
as in you wouldn't do
this,
that if you're in terrible circumstance, you definitely wouldn't teach him about God.
In the film version, what they actually do is they put in the more common approach, which is to say, gee, you've suffered a terrible life, you must have thought God had deserted you. But the book has it completely the other way around, which is she is in a terrible circumstance, but the one thing she won't let go of is God. Yeah, and to me, I think that's a very encouraging thing. So look, great film. What I would do is encourage you to read the book.
And just to go and see the film, if you can, if you can withstand. Room is predictably rated M for mature themes and coarse language. But it's more heart-rending than harrowing.
Yes, it's not terrifying. It is emotional.
It's just emotionally draining. The film stars, as you mentioned, Brie Larson and the incredibly talented Jacob Tremblay. That kid's probably going to go a long way. It opened last week at selected cinemas and, as we keep saying, well worth a look.
Well worth it.
Mate, what's coming up later on the show?
Well, actually, before I get to that, I should just point out...
Sorry, I'm moving on way too quick.
In Eternity is one of the great supporters of our show. And look, Eternity is a national newspaper for Christians. We've actually got some material which we popped into Eternity for you. So if you'd like to read more on Spotlight, which is the film we were talking about last week, or Room, which is the one that I just talked about then, I've got two articles in the edition of Eternity coming up and online, so you can go see them there. And we just recommend that you read and think through. They're both powerful films, Spotlight and Room.
All right. Well, given you've just plugged that, I might as well say what's going to come up on the show then.
Please, I don't want to hog the whole
show. I was throwing that question out there, but I already know. We're going to talk about the new film Steve Jobs and also the true uncut story of what it's like to take your baby to the cinema.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the new drama thriller Room, quite the emotional experience as it centres on the intense relationship between a mum and her son imprisoned in a single room. That sort of sounds like what I imagine is the experience of many parents as they go to one of those mums and bub sessions at the local cinema.
It does sound like that.
There they are. I mean, they're in prison with a lot of other mums and bubs doing the same sort of thing. Look, but what are these screenings actually like? I'm only on the outside looking in. I've never been there either. Yeah. To find out, though, you caught up with Millie Howson-Brown?
I did.
A film and TV production professional.
She is.
Who is also a seasoned mum and bub audience member.
You are able to take your child in, so carers with babies go in.
Yeah. And what kind of ages of kids are we talking?
Oh, anything from newborn. Well, okay, so you don't pay for your child from newborn to 5.
Awesome, don't pay, right on.
So it's free.
Yeah, you have me at free. So what kind of age range does it go up to? Mums and carers take kids who are 5?
You tend not to. I have seen, say, roughly, say, a 2.5, say 3-year-old, but they get quite flustered and don't want to be seeing a movie that necessarily mum or a carer would want to see.
Right, right. I'll get back to that, the kinds of movies that are shown at mums and bubs screenings, but what actually happens?
So what the difference with a real bubs or a bubs club screening is that the lights are dimmed and the sound is reduced, and that's primarily for the comfort of the child. It means that the parent or the carer is able to do what they do as a carer, and be able to look at their child and also and also watch the film at the same time.
And how many have you been to?
Too many to mention. I actually could not count. I have seen that many because I am such a huge cinema going fan.
Well, and also a fan of Mums and Bubs by the sound.
Yeah, definitely.
How come?
Big advocate. Because I see it as it feeds my passion and hobby for cinema going. It's different seeing a film at the cinema than it is at home. But also I get to enjoy it whilst being in this new fashioned title of being a mum. Yes. So I can take my child and enjoy it with them.
Yeah, yeah. And you can actually enjoy it because I'm picturing like a room, and this is a terrible cliche, but I'm picturing like a room full of screaming children.
It is acceptable for there to be noisy babies, but you focus on the film because, as I said, the sound is reduced, so the babies can cry, and that's absolutely acceptable. And that, to me, is one of the benefits of going to these things. Your baby can cry. Your baby can whimper. Your baby can actually just coo and gaga, which is, to be honest, is totally adorable when you hear a baby giggle or coo during a film, even if it's in a perilous moment, a peril moment, like whatever. It's just, it's adorable. I feel like I flick my eyes up from the cinema down to my child off and on.
I take it sometimes you have to do toilet breaks and feeding breaks, that kind of thing.
Correct. You feed during the film. And that's, again, the other benefit is that you can breastfeed your child, you can feed your child, you know, solids, whatever, and there is absolutely no judgment. Other carers do it at the same time, and if anything, everyone's really supportive, and I love that kind of supportive community.
And what kind of movies get shown?
It's everything from the lower budget Australian films, whether it's like Last Cab to Darwin, Dressmaker, Holding the Man, to something like more big budget, say like The Martian or Bridge of Spies, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay, all over the shop. Is there anything that you wouldn't take your baby to?
Yes, they tend not to screen them though. So as I like Quentin Tarantino films, but I wouldn't necessarily want to take my child to that. I figured that would hormonally break me.
That's a good way to put that, yes. I reckon it would. And so my final question then, Millie, is how much of a bonding experience is it for you as a movie-loving mum with your baby heading along to the cinema?
Well, what it does, it actually heightens every single emotion. So if it's sad on the screen, then you can look down at your child and maybe shed a tear with them, as quaint that sounds. Or if it's incredibly loving on the screen, then you look down with your child and have a closer cuddle. It's just, it's beautiful, I feel.
Sometimes Ben likes to think that he's had a major impact on the world. Well, he's going to have a major impact on my character. That's on my patience. All sorts of things. But
please go on. More about you, Mark, and less about my impact on the world.
Yeah, see, there you are again.
Always about thinking about my major impact. Yes.
Someone who's actually had a major impact on the world is Steve Jobs, the tech visionary behind so many of the eye gadgets that now rule our lives. Well, Steve Jobs, the movie, is a new release starring Michael Fassbender as the Apple man himself. And it's up for a few Oscars. Steve Jobs is a biopic that gets personal about whether being a success means that you also have to be a total jerk.
What do you do? You're not an engineer. You're not a designer. You can't put a hammer to a nail. I built the circuit board. The graphical interface was stolen. So how come 10 times in a day I read Steve Jobs as a genius? What do you do?
Musicians play their instruments. I play the orchestra.
I hear you've been worse than usual this morning. I didn't think that was possible.
It's a system error.
Fix it.
Fix it?
Yeah.
We're not a pit crew at Daytona. This can't be fixed in seconds.
You didn't have seconds. You had 3 weeks. The universe was created in a third of that time.
Well, someday you'll have to tell us how you did it.
Zing.
Wow.
And that's, man, the dialogue in this film is fantastic. As you'd expect, this is from screenwriter Aaron Sorkin, most famous for The West Wing and then everything through to The Social Network that he's touched. His dialogue always sounds the same, doesn't it? But in this movie, it really sings. I think he does a really great job, very well situated in the world of Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs in the movie land is set across three different time periods, 1984, 1988, and 1999. And all three periods, we see Steve Jobs as he's about to launch some major product. Two of them are Macintosh, Apple Macintosh, and one of them is another one that he was working for in between. And at each product launch, before he's about to give a speech, this movie in thirds focuses on Steve Jobs as he basically gets into a fight or some kind of debate or some really eloquent speech with all these major figures in his life, everyone from the people who work closest with him to a woman who claims that he is the mother of her daughter. Mm. And so it's a little bit forced. Let's just say that. This is definitely a movie. This is as Aaron Sorkin was describing it, saying he's not trying to go for a straight picture, a snapshot of Steve Jobs. It's more of a portrait that he's trying to give. He's trying to demonstrate a man's character as opposed to being 100% beholden to the truth.
Mm. So it's not like Jobs, which was very much a straight biopic.
But the one with Ashton Kutcher Steve Jobs.
Like beginning to end.
I didn't actually see that.
Started with his almost birth and then finished with his death, yeah.
No, it definitely isn't. And I heard that version of Steve Jobs really sets out to effectively paint him like a saint.
Is this not a loving tribute?
No, it's not a loving tribute, but I don't know if it's unloving. I found it a bit hard to tell. I don't know heaps about Steve Jobs. I went and tried to research him a little bit after seeing the movie. I found that, as you can expect from the way I just described the setup of the movie in these three stages and the fact that all these characters in his life are forced into these situations that didn't actually occur in real life, there's that didn't actually happen in real life. These situations didn't occur. But then a lot of the things that happen in amongst their exchanges, everything from some of the stuff that Steve Jobs says or gets accused of didn't actually happen either. There's a lot of truth that's slipped through. So you could allege that Aaron Sorkin and director Danny Boyle, who's I think best known for Slumdog Millionaire, that the two of them got together and tried to do a hatchet job on Steve Jobs. I don't think so, though. I didn't feel like the movie was trying to tear the guy down. But do you
come away thinking Steve Jobs, visionary?
You do, because he often tells you that over and over again. And it's true. Like the guy was, and you can't really get past that. He does come off as an arrogant jerk for most of the movie, but quite a likable one. I think they've tried to paint a guy who was so fiercely driven by what he believed about himself and what he wanted to do that everything else didn't matter in his life. And Michael Fassbender does an excellent job of being the charismatic center of a self-centered universe.
So that explains the Oscar nominations. But you basically...
that goes down to the big speeches.
But you're basically saying that the structure kind of gets a bit in the way of it.
Yes and no. It's interesting that it does cram so many issues into the movie. I think that's a good thing. I think Aaron Sorkin's made a wise choice of how do I represent a man? Well, I'm going to use these devices of all these different product launches and put him up at different points in his life and demonstrate what was going on for him personally and in business. You go, oh, that's great. And you can bring in all kinds of stuff. But then the negative is, I think it is too forced. And also you sit there kind of rolling your eyes a bit thinking, again? Like you're having a stand-up argument with your daughter again? You're having another fight with this lady who you keep saying isn't the mother of your child again? That gets a bit draining on you. But the actors carried off beautifully, and Aaron Sorkin can write his way out of any issue, really. Mm. Any problem that he faces in the screenplay that he set up.
Let's talk about the person we're basically meeting. Steve Jobs, genius. Okay, no trouble there. Do geniuses have to be jerks to get through? You talk about this force of nature character. Do they have to be like that?
I'd say no. What is Steve Jobs saying? I don't think it's saying that either. I think it's definitely trying to suggest that there can be. There's a great line in the movie that says it's not binary. You can be decent and gifted at the same time. I think that's ultimately the message coming through about Steve Jobs. Almost a bittersweet message that you see the amazing success that this man had, but at the same time you see how the way he went about that success basically tore down everything around him. And I think that's a bit strained in the film. It's a bit over the top, exaggerated, but there's definitely truth in that about Steve Jobs. So I think walking away from that as a viewer, it'd be great to talk about with all your mates on this topic, is what do you think success actually is? What would it take to achieve that? And go back to this question, do you think you can be decent and gifted at the same time? Is that possible? And Steve Jobs, the man in this movie, would suggest no. And I reckon it's a great one to talk about. What do you think? Because what actually makes for success in our lives and at what cost? Oh, and greatness. Steve Jobs raises all that.
Mm. Okay, well, Steve Jobs stars Michael Fassbender, Kate Winslet, Seth Rogen, and those early models of Mac computers that now look so dorky and funny.
They really do.
It's rated M for some swearing and mature themes and Macs.
Max. Okay. Mate, still to come on the show, we are going to dig an old sci-fi classic out of the vault. And then you're going a little bit sci-fi too on your top five list for this week.
I always go a bit sci-fi.
But this time, fully sci-fi.
Welcome back. And if in fact you're looking for more of The Big Picture before we sort of round out our program
yes.
for this week.
Where can we find more of The Big Picture, Mark?
TheBigPictureWebsite.com.
I wish I'd heard of that before.
TheBigPictureWebsite.com.
I keep going with that.
I know. How can you do that?
Sorry,
TheBigPictureWebsite.com. Just by the way, you actually have to use the word website. It's TheBigPictureWebsite.com. Because we couldn't afford the other one. So there you go.
But it's priceless when you get there.
And it's got fantastic stuff, all sorts of reviews and things of past weeks and articles that we never actually get around time to share. Also, last year's 43 episodes. You can look for all sorts of things. Okay, well, coming up this week, we're actually going to talk about The Vault. It's in fact the second show for 2016 and the first time that one of our regular segments, The Vault, has returned. For those who may not have spent time in The Vault, you're in time for a time travel treat. As we venture back into the enormous and exciting catalogue that we call All Movies Ever.
All Movies Ever.
Insights editor and movie maestro Adrian Rayton leads us through each vault expedition with his cute little cap and sort of like light sort of perched on
top.
He's
such a trusty leader.
Picking something cool, powerful or unforgettable that any self-respecting film fan needs to see. What better way to kick off 2016 than by Adrian bringing us one of sci-fi cinema's greatest achievements? I, for one, can't think of a better way.
Well, you may ask Ben why I've chosen Blade Runner from The Vault to review, especially since it was a flop on its theatrical release in 1982.
Okay, mate, I will ask you why, Adrian, have you chosen Blade Runner to review when it was a flop on theatrical review in when? 1982?
Yeah, 1982.
Yep.
I'm glad you asked.
Thank you.
Because in the heady 80s, we'd become used to the space opera stylings of Star Wars.
Of course.
Battlestar Galactica and even grittier Alien. And here was a sci-fi film that used the noir film noir detective stylings of the 70s.
And even earlier, though, like from the 20s and 30s, those kind of noir stylings
yeah.
too.
Yeah, yeah, and repurposed it for the sci-fi audience.
Yeah. Why do you think it tanked when it first came out? Because people were just used to Star Wars? Do you reckon that's the reason?
Well, I think, yeah, because we were used to space operas and, you know, lots of dogfights in space and all that sort of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's kind of more of a think film. It's I think it wasn't as well received. Also, because I think it was very badly edited on its first theatrical release, which is I can talk about a bit later, because Ridley Scott remastered and redid the film to the way he wanted to do it, and it was released much later. In fact, in 2007.
And in that time, that's like a 25-year period. Blade Runner became known as a classic throughout that time, didn't it?
It did, and the story is set in the year 2019. Yes, that's just 3 years away.
Yeah.
And the sci-fi aficionados, I suppose, Blade Runner is the go-to film. Firstly, it's visually stunning in its imagining of kind of a near future as this sort of cornucopia of skyborne advertising, vast skyscrapers and gritty kind of Chinese-styled streets, and it rains a lot.
Yeah, it does. It does. But it has Harrison Ford going around as a detective trying to work out, trying to chase down these androids, isn't he? Trying to find these androids that are on the loose.
Yeah, they're called replicants.
Yes.
They're synthetic humans who've failed the empathy tests and are on the run from their authorities. And these replicants are the brainchild of the Tyrell Corporation, these gigantic skyscraper kind of towers over the LA landscape. And their advertising says they're more human than human.
Oh, so, now that to me points to deeper things that we can take away from Blade Runner, which leads me to a final question, Adrian, about it sounds to me like you are very struck by Blade Runner and think we should go and watch it. Is it because of the visuals and the look and feel of the story, or is there something else to it that we should be chewing over?
A bit of both, because Deckard, the character played by Harrison Ford, Rick Deckard, to me is every bit as great a character as Han Solo or even Indiana Jones. It's his kind of most interesting performance, but it throws up for me a lot of really interesting questions, like what makes us human?
Mm.
Can we ever actually replicate humans successfully? what is actually the nature of empathy and what would society be like if we all lacked empathy? These are all pretty important questions that sort of tie us to our creator God and the plan he has for our lives. And I think it's a film worth checking out, particularly as a sequel is planned for the film this year. In July, they're starting filming to be directed by Ridley Scott again and starring Harrison Ford and Ryan Gosling.
Whoa, okay.
It'll be interesting to see how they continue the story of Rick Deckard.
But before that comes out, go and check out the original Blade Runner from 1982.
Absolutely.
Thanks, mate.
This week in our top five, we decided to take a lead from Adrian Drayton and his celebration of Blade Runner. And of course, he was talking about a fantasy world where corporate giants are more powerful than governments, people live or die according to their pay packets, and we're surrounded by machines that are smarter than the average person. Yes, fantasy. But I thought it was worth taking the time to consider those occasions where I'm glad, or soon will be very glad, when the scriptwriters actually got it right. So to complete our second show of the year, I give you my top five sci-fi tops reality moments.
Five.
My first sci-fi tops reality moment is actually not so much
as in topping
sci-fi,
reality. That's what you're getting at.
Better than
even
reality.
Even better than.
And one day will be. One day will be true, or sci-fi got it right, and we should be thankful. It comes from Thunderball in 1965.
Yes.
It's the jetpack.
I
know this is a bone of contention because I've actually seen people wearing t-shirts saying, "It's the future, where's my jetpack?" Okay, we've been expecting that, but only the other day I was sitting in a car behind a bus and it advertised that you could ride a jetpack in Sydney.
Where can you do that? Not
well,
that we're
when
promoting
I went down to check out
this
what this jetpack was, it wasn't as much as what I thought it was. It's basically, imagine attaching two really big hoses to your feet while you're in a pool and being launched off your feet and probably cracking your skull on the side of the pool.
What I'm imagining is really lame and nothing like what happened
but
in Thunderball.
That's why it's at number five.
Four.
Because at number four, sci-fi really topped reality and brought it home to us in Independence Day in 1996. In Independence Day in 1996...
It did. I'm living in fear ever since.
We imagined this amazing world, this incredible world where machines could talk to each other.
Da, da, da.
And of course, it was just Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi turned up a few years later and we're, oh my goodness me, now the aliens can arrive. And that's what it was. I firmly believe they didn't actually come up with Wi-Fi. The aliens just arrived on the planet finally.
So, hang on, what? So you believe what you're saying is Wi-Fi was invented by aliens, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes, and I for one would like to thank our future overlords for that invention. Moving on to number three. Now, in 1984, there was another wonderful moment where in which technology promised something that would finally top reality and make us feel happy about ourselves. And it came in the form of the film Electric Dreams. Okay, Electric Dreams
promised
something.
Few people have discussed Electric Dreams since 1984, Mark. For those listening who have no idea what Electric Dreams is.
Electric Dreams was about a computer that gained some form of consciousness and also had the ability to manipulate other machines and things like that.
Did it play the cello?
It did. It did all sorts of wonderful things.
Because it's such a loving
it
machine.
It predicted the Internet of Things. Now, what's basically happened now is that you can actually get microchips so small and so cheaply that they can be in all sorts of things. So, for example, NEC gives you a variety of light bulbs that you can have now with a computer chip in them, stick them in the socket, and hey presto, download the app. You can be dimming your lights with no more effect than just a normal light bulb. Now, that light bulb does cost about $60, but there you go. You know, so, Internet of Things.
So you believe that the NEC executive were watching a rerun of Electric Dreams one time.
They came
this
up
forgotten
with
sci-fi love ballad thing from the 80s.
And thanks to that, now we have this Internet of Things idea.
Thanks to Electric Dreams. I'm just getting this clear.
And yep. My fridge can finally have that longed-for relationship it wanted with my toaster.
Okay. Two.
What other moments have we seen in film where in which technology has reached down and finally enriched us till reality arrives and we find out we're living in the future? Well, I give you Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of course, gets it back had to Star
happen.
Trek.
It had to happen. Yes. Now, I want to say now, we've talked about Steve Jobs, but we have not thanked Steve Jobs for making Star Trek The Next Generation a reality, because we have the iPad. Look closely, my friends, and you'll realize that we are all now little Captain Picards, walking around with our iPads, dotting around on the screen. Suddenly,
Captain Picard had an iPad?
Yeah, basically.
Says the guy who doesn't watch Star Trek?
Yeah, you should watch Star Trek.
What, to see iPads? I can see them on the street all the time. How long ago did Captain Picard, that's...
1987.
Patrick Stewart's character in...
Patrick Stewart.
1987.
1987, he was using an iPad long before Steve Jobs had even thought of the iPhone.
Why didn't he tell Steve Jobs? Why did he keep it to himself, Captain Picard?
I think he did. That's the thing. Don't call me a conspiracy theorist for nothing. Steve Jobs came out with the iPad a mere 13 years later.
What could possibly be you claiming Steve Jobs ripped off Star Trek?
Here we go. Well, I'm now going to take us back to the genesis of all modern technology which you enjoy today. The 1966 launch of Star Trek. Okay.
You got Star Trek onto a list twice. This is the only reason you put this list together.
No, no, no. Now, hang on a second. I'm talking about the original series, and as any Star Trek person knows, there's a huge difference between the Next Generation and the original series. Okay, in 1966, the series came out, and they just started a whole range of products which we'd never thought about before. Communication devices you stick in your ear, and you can talk to them. You know, so screens, flat screens.
They didn't have those massive backs on them that took up half your
computers that you talk to. Where do you think Siri turned up? But my favorite was actually a patent made by Google last year. Okay, last year, Google took out a patent on a device that was supposed to be their answer to the Apple Watch, okay? So imagine this device, if you will. It can be almost any shape. It could be like a cufflink or something that you put in your pocket or maybe a brooch that you pin, but it's acting very much like a phone. And all you have to do to activate the phone is to tap your chest. Yes, I'm talking about the Star Trek communicator. Google patented it. And now I want them to produce it. I want to be able to sit in a world where I can tap my chest and say, Siri, what star date is it?
Daymata Bridge.
Chakotay here.
Daymata Bridge, report. It's close enough. Bridge, start the decompression sequence.
Acknowledged.
Janeway to Khan.
Paris here, Captain.
Or I want to be able to tap my chest and say, children, it's time for bed. You know, or... Mark to kitchen. Darling, I'm almost home for dinner.
Wow, Mark, you just want to live in the Star Trek universe for real.
Well, that would be okay, except for the velour is very hot to wear on those sort of shirts. What's coming up next week, Ben?
Back to reality after your top five. What sci-fi moments that reality topped or top reality?
Sci-fi top reality.
I was just getting lost in there about the surrealism of movies blending with real life. Oh, but that was this show. We'll talk about next week. What's coming up next week? We're going to talk about Deadpool.
Deadpool.
The new superhero movie with a twist, yeah, I believe.
Not only that, we're going to be looking at Brooklyn.
Okay, we are.
A international love affair set so much in the 1800s.
And we're going to talk about one of your personal favourites, Downton Abbey.
When I'm not watching sci-fi, I'm watching period drama.
I'm definitely not, but I'm still Ben McKechnie.
And I'm Mark Hadley. See you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.